The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here on Monday, September the 8th. Today, new Tories, new danger? We ask how David Cameron's Conservatives would govern.
No unfunded tax cuts. That's what William Hague proposed and Michael Howe proposed. And hey, guess what happened? They lost the election.
The United Nations is threatening to put national landmarks such as the Tower of London on its list of World Heritage Sites in danger.
The threat is undoubtedly causing the UK government and planners in London some anxiety.
Many more civilians are being killed in US and NATO airstrikes in Afghanistan than need be the case, according to new analysis today from Human Rights Watch.
It's in these knee-jerk troops in contact situation where their forces call in airstrikes during a firefight and they haven't planned and taken all the precautions that we see civilians killed by airstrikes.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Bill Overton with today's news headlines and a look at the papers.
Hurricane Ike has hit Cuba after destroying crops and causing more floods across Haiti. It's the second hurricane to hit the islands this year. At least 58 people are believed to have died on Haiti, but the Category 3 hurricane didn't cause any deaths in the Turks and Caicos Islands. It's forecast to sweep the whole length of Cuba and hit the capital, Havana. The United States has launched the biggest financial bailout in the country's history. The Federal Housing Finance Agency will now run the main mortgage lenders, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, after the government underwriting its $2.7 trillion of home loans. The Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says the two institutions are so big and so interwoven in the financial system that a failure of either of them would affect the whole world economy. It's hoped that backing them may start to turn back the credit crunch. But the Conservative Party's Shadow Chancellor says Britain's facing economic recession. In an interview with The Guardian, he says the economic mess will leave his party in a straitjacket when they take over government. We'll have the full story later in Guardian Daily. The UN's threatening to put the Tower of London on its list of worst heritage sites in danger. It's accusing Britain of damaging Stonehenge and the old centres of Edinburgh and Bath. The UN has said it wants urgent action to protect seven sites across the country, as we'll hear from our Scotland correspondent later in the programme. Britain's tennis number one Andy Murray's reached his first Grand Slam final. In the US Open, he was two sets ahead when rain stopped play on Saturday. When they restarted, Nadal won the next set, but Murray managed to force his way back to take another winning set. If he beats Roger Federer, he'll be the first British Grand Slam winner in 72 years. But bad news for British Formula One driver Lewis Hamilton. He crossed the finish line first in the Belgian Grand Prix, but was ruled to have cut a corner while overtaking and given a time penalty, which pushed him back into third place. The US takeover of its mortgage giants gets into almost all the morning papers, with The Telegraph calling it the world's biggest mortgage bailout. The Financial Times says that it is de facto nationalisation. The Independent says the US government's ripped up years of economic policies. The Mirror and the Mail ask, when will it stop raining in Britain? But answer that the storms and rain will batter this country for the next week as the tail end of the Caribbean hurricanes. While The Guardian talks to the Tories, George Osborne on its front page, The Times says this week at the TUC annual conference, Gordon Brown will take on the doubters. But it also gives space to a picture of Lewis Hamilton opening champagne, saying, "Put the cork back in, Lewis. You actually came third." There's more news throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Britain is heading for an economic recession. And if opinion polls are to be believed, in less than 2 years' time, it'll be a Tory government that will be tasked with reviving the economy. The Shadow Chancellor George Osborne has been speaking to The Guardian, which, in a series this week, asks if David Cameron's Conservatives are up to the job of governing. Our chief political correspondent, Nick Watt, told me about George Osborne's plans.
Well, indeed, George Osborne is saying that he's going to inherit an economic mess. He's told us this morning that the way that Gordon Brown has run the Treasury and indeed the way that the economy has been turning down is going to impose what he's calling a straitjacket on this government and indeed on his government if he wins the next general election. And that is going to be tricky. But what they're talking about doing is drawing up a series of new rules to basically change the way that we raise taxes and spend money in this country. They're going to talk about a new fiscal framework. It's basically, without going into too much detail, going to be much stricter, and it's going to prevent what they describe as the sort of reckless borrowing that Gordon Brown has used to finance a lot of his public spending increases in recent years.
This week, The Guardian's having a series of articles looking in some depth at what the next Tory government might be like. The old-style Conservatives, of course, would have introduced tax breaks for the rich, cut public spending. Is that going to be the case with George Osborne and David Cameron?
Well, it's interesting. George Osborne, who, let us not forget, was political secretary to William Hague when he was leader of the Conservative Party, so he knows a few things about heading to the right. George Osborne makes pretty clear that those days are in the past, because those sort of days just mean that you only get a vote share of about 30%. They want to win the election, which means they've got to be pushing 44% of the national vote. And he's making absolutely clear, no unfunded tax cuts. That's what William Hague proposed and Michael Howe proposed. And hey, guess what happened? They lost the election. And crucially, on public services, they're saying we have absolutely accepted the key core Labour settlement, which is that public services should be funded entirely out of taxation. No, as he says, unrealistic social insurance schemes. We absolutely accept that. But what we do question is the delivery of public services. And he says in his interview that we should be quite prepared to allow the private sector, to allow voluntary groups and to allow charities to run key public services, schools, hospitals and back-to-work programmes for the unemployed. May sound a bit familiar, isn't it? Guess who introduced some of those thoughts? Tony Blair. The Tories are pretty open, saying, yeah, we quite liked what we saw from Tony Blair in the last few years. But there... line is that Tony Blair was stopped by Gordon Brown and they will introduce true Blairism.
As you say, it sounds very familiar. Are the Tories really just going to be promising more of the same, or are they offering anything different that we haven't seen before?
In terms of, is there a big philosophical difference between the two parties? I think there is, because the Tories are saying we won't offer any unfunded tax cuts, but they do say we still believe that a low tax economy is a better economy. Eventually, we would love at some point in the future to reduce the overall tax burden. Gordon Brown believes very firmly that public services can only be financed at a reasonably high level through taxes, and he would keep the tax burden in the long term at a higher level. So no, it's not like the difference between, let's say, Margaret Thatcher and the Labour Party of Michael Foot, but certainly there are differences between the two main parties.
David Cameron says that the Tories are now the true champions of progressive ideals, and George Osborne in his interview with The Guardian calls on trade unionists to recognise that the Tories are now the main socially liberal progressive party. I mean, many Guardian readers and trade unionists will take this with a big pinch of salt.
Well, some trade union leaders who are indeed gathering for the TUC conference this week will regard that as a little cheeky, but George Osborne would say, I'm not aiming it at the trade union leaders. I know they're going to carry on financing the Labour Party and demanding that the Labour Party moves even further to the left. But, he would say, I'm aiming it at trade union members. And, of course, let us not forget that one of the things that made Margaret Thatcher so successful was she did get a lot of trade unionists voting for her in that 1979 general election that brought her to power. And he would say that, essentially, Labour talks a good game, but they are failing. And so how can they talk about being the champions of progressive ideals? Because surely tackling poverty is about progressive ideals. If they are, as the Tories would say, failing, it's time to try a new approach. And they would say our approach, which they're calling the bottom-up approach, which is you let people on the ground, charities and voluntary groups, have a much bigger role, they would say you should give that a new go.
The Conservatives are often accused by Labour of lacking substance. Do their policies stand up to scrutiny?
I think the Tories would reply that they've really done two very important things. The first important thing is to have an overarching philosophy. They would say we now have a very clear philosophy, and we do have within that framework some pretty clear policies. So take, for example, welfare reform. They will say that clearly the state bringing the long-term unemployed back to work hasn't worked. So what we will do, the Conservatives, is say to private companies, if you can succeed in getting people back to work and keeping them there, that's the crucial thing, for 2 years, then you'll get paid, and you'll get paid handsomely. They would have a similar system for prisoners to try and stop reoffending rates.
Nick Watt. And there's more on the Conservatives today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, the Disability Minister, Anne Maguire, is live online from 2:30pm to answer your questions about the government's welfare reform plans. Post a question for her at societyguardian.co.uk. An EU ban on ads with sexist overtones. It's another quasi-fictional piece of translucent flimflam. That's the view of our columnist Charlie Brooker. At guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And we've got pictures, reports and gossip from New York Fashion Week at guardian.co.uk/fashion.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The Palace of Westminster, Bath's Georgian Crescents and Edinburgh's medieval Old Town are among the UK's architectural jewels that have been classed as World Heritage Sites by the United Nations cultural arm, UNESCO. But now UNESCO is considering putting all of them, plus the Tower of London, Stonehenge, Liverpool's Maritime City Centre and Orkney's Neolithic ruins, on its list of World Heritage Sites in danger. UNESCO says we're not looking after them properly. With the details is The Guardian's Severin Carell.
UNESCO and its advisers in the UK, an organisation called ICOMOS, have actually got pretty detailed concerns which differ for each of the sites. But in summary, you could say that they are that the UK is too keen to press ahead with big prestige developments and economic development at the expense of its heritage, and that the balance between preserving the UK's heritage and pressing ahead with major prestige tower blocks like the Shard of Glass in London or a big project in Edinburgh called the Colton Gate, it's gone in the wrong direction, that basically we aren't sensitive enough to the need to preserve our World Heritage sites.
I mean, on this list of sites that it thinks that we're not looking after properly, they range from Stonehenge to the Tower of London. I mean, to think that we're not protecting these national treasures is deeply shaming, isn't it?
Well, for a lot of people, it will be. I mean, you know, there is, of course, an argument from a lot of architects and developers and indeed the city councils involved here that we really do have to keep up with 21st century developments. We need modern developments. We need new tower blocks. We need new places for people to live. But some of these criticisms for UNESCO are problematic for the UK. I mean, take Stonehenge, for instance. When Stonehenge was listed in 1986, UNESCO was given assurances by the British government of the day that we would actually protect the site by moving the A344 and building a new visitor centre away from the site. Now, 22 years later, nothing has been done. And as UNESCO points out with some irritation and anger, it feels that it's been let down very badly, and the British government constantly moves the goalposts on this. However, the funny thing is, of course, with these sorts of things is that these are quite detailed arguments, and even some conservationists recognise that the British government does have a problem with Stonehenge, for instance, because the costs of burying the A344 in this big tunnel are, I believe, in the order of £1 billion, and even conservationists at Save Britain's Heritage think that maybe UNESCO may be misunderstanding the expense involved.
Is there anything that UNESCO can do to make Britain take better care of its heritage?
Well, yes, it can embarrass the UK, and it's proposing to do so. I mean, we already know that the visits that UNESCO inspectors will be making to the cities of Edinburgh and Bath in the next couple of months are embarrassing the local city authorities. There's no doubt about that. But the threat also of putting, say, the Tower of London on the list of World Heritage Sites in danger next year is undoubtedly causing the UK government and planners in London some anxiety. We know from the Department for Culture, Media and Sport that they fought very, very hard to try and dilute UNESCO's concerns when UNESCO's World Heritage Committee met in Quebec in July. They managed to persuade the UNESCO World Heritage Committee to block a threat to put the Palace of Westminster, which includes, you know, the Houses of Commons, Lords, the Westminster Abbey and St Margaret's Church, on this list of World Heritage Sites in danger next year. So they have had some success. And also DCMS is, for England, introducing a new piece of legislation which the government insists will give all English World Heritage Sites a new level of protection under the Heritage Protection Bill, automatically making every area that has a World Heritage Site a conservation area. Now, the government insists this will be a major step towards ensuring that new planning proposals are properly evaluated and aren't introduced too hastily and aren't going to damage the sites in question. The similar sorts of measures aren't being considered in Scotland. The authorities in Scotland believe that the Scottish system is effective enough, although I have to say some architects would probably disagree.
Severin Carell. I'm John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come in today's programme, the shocking treatment of children in Baghdad's prisons.
The Iraqi government is sitting on billions of dollars of revenue from oil exports, and they're not spending it. Couldn't they spend $1 million to improve the living conditions for these young men?
And from the front line of Britain's flash floods, Martin Wainwright reports from North Yorkshire.
When I came in from shopping, I walked along here, then all of a sudden the water came from here and I had to run into the house.
But first, in Afghanistan, more than 1,600 civilians were killed in 2007. And that's almost three times as many civilians as died the previous year, according to a report today from the New York-based international campaign group Human Rights Watch. Mark Garlasco is senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch, and he says ordinary Afghan civilians have borne the brunt of the US and NATO's air war against the Taliban.
Even as the missions in Afghanistan have tried to create a level of stability in the country, the reality is that everyday life for civilians there has become ever more difficult under the U.S. and NATO occupation. And really the issue that we have now is that you have a dual mission going on. You have the U.S. counterterrorism mission, which is completely separate from the NATO stability operations that are ongoing. And we've really seen that the U.S. counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan is clearly undermining the NATO stability operation that's going on.
I mean, every time civilians are killed, it makes it harder for Western forces to count on the support of ordinary Afghans.
Well, I mean, it's clear, you know, U.S. forces have caused hundreds of civilian deaths that could have been prevented. And, you know, it's to the benefit of all the armies to obtain the trust of the population. You know, causing needless civilian deaths is not the way to gain that trust. And that's really been one of the core problems that we've seen in Afghanistan over the last years. And it's been increasing. And one would think that they would be taking some efforts to make changes to reduce those civilian casualties. But as we saw from 2006 to 2007, civilian casualties tripled from airstrikes alone. And we see them this year going up again. And it's a grave concern.
What's the reason for this acceleration in the number of civilian deaths?
Well, you know, there's no silver bullet in what's going on. I mean, clearly we do have increased hostilities in the country. That's obvious. But there are a number of issues happening right now. I mean, one clearly is the U.S. counterterrorism mission, completely separate from the NATO stability operations. You have different rules of engagement, different command structure, different communications, and different liaison. You also have an issue where when civilians are killed, the U.S. does a really piecemeal job of investigating and trying to learn from what's happening when civilians are killed. I mean, clearly the investigations that we've seen have been unilateral and opaque at best. Additionally, you know, they're not using the same types of low collateral damage weapons that they're using in Iraq. And so we're seeing some of the very large weapons go down in Afghanistan. And then, you know, finally, we also have a situation where the U.S. time and again blames the Taliban and doesn't want to take responsibility for their own actions.
Although many of these deaths have been caused because the Taliban's been using civilians as human shields, which violates international laws of war.
That's right, you know, and we have found a number of incidents where the Taliban purposefully kept civilians from leaving their homes just to shield themselves from the attack. But, you know, such practices don't mean the U.S. can bomb populated villages without regard for the civilian population. I mean, there were a number of cases that we investigated where there was no evidence of shielding. And just the mere presence of civilians near combatants is not proof that they were forced to stay there. And even if the Taliban is using civilians as shields, the U.S. has a clear obligation under international law to take all feasible precautions to avoid that harm. I mean, just because the Taliban is violating international law does not allow the U.S. to do it.
Why aren't the U.S. taking the precautions in Afghanistan to protect civilians that you think they are elsewhere in places such as Iraq?
Well, simply it's one word, and that's numbers. They just don't have the forces on the ground that they have in Iraq. They are having to replace boots on the ground with bombs on target. And when you try to do that, you know, it's very difficult to be as careful as you should be. No civilian casualties that we have investigated, or minimal at best, have been caused by planned airstrikes. So the U.S. is very, very good at it when they take the time to plan it through from beginning to end. But it's in these, you know, knee-jerk troops in contact situation where their forces call in airstrikes during a firefight or when they see someone walking around that they think they need to kill and they haven't planned and taken all the precautions, you know, the wedding party on the ridge, that we see civilians killed by airstrikes. And so clearly they know how to do it when they take the time to do it, but they don't always take the precautions.
That's Mark Garlesco from Human Rights Watch. And a surgical crew chief, aged 24, recounts the most traumatic mission he's ever flown in the latest video report from John D. McHugh at guardian.co.uk/Afghanistan today. Children as young as 9 are being held in appalling conditions in Baghdad's prisons. They're sleeping in 100-degree temperatures, in overcrowded cells, without working fans or daily access to showers. And they're also regularly sexually abused by guards. The Guardian's been speaking to current and former prisoners. Here's our senior foreign correspondent, Jonathan Steele.
The heat there is the worst problem at the moment. The temperatures in Baghdad are around 112 degrees Fahrenheit by day. They hardly drop below 100 degrees or 40 degrees centigrade by night. The electricity, which is supposed to fuel the fans, doesn't work. It's only put on for 2 hours a week. That's on Sunday when the visitors come in. And as one of these young men said, for about 2 or 3 hours in the evening, but not during the night. The inmates suspect that the guards are actually selling the fuel for the generator on the black market. So they could have electricity, but they're not getting it. They also say that the guards occasionally allow one or two of them to telephone home on their cell phones, but the guards demand that the families of the boy top up the phones with $10 or $20 each time. And of course, very often they don't let them use the phone. So these kids are completely isolated in this terrible heat. Some of them have awful skin sores from lying in these sweat-soaked mattresses. They're sweating profusely all night in this heat. The boy who we visited said that he only gets access to a shower once every 3 days because the water supply is not adequate. So you can imagine the conditions. And some children are actually sleeping on the floor. Others are in double bunks, rows of double bunks. But it's so overcrowded that some are actually sleeping on the concrete floor.
What sort of crimes are these young people supposed to have committed?
Well, a few are for petty offences, criminal offences, but a large number are for security offences. But the evidence that they were really taking part in some terrorism at that young age, because some of these children are as young as 9, must be a little bit dubious. The trials are not properly conducted. And we know that there has been a lot of sectarian prejudice and unfairness perpetrated, particularly by the Iraqi police, who are largely Shia-dominated. Most of these kids are Sunnis, and they are rounded up as part of this general sectarian violence that has been going on for the last 2 or 3 years in Baghdad.
The United Nations has expressed its concern about conditions in Iraqi jails. What has been the official response to this?
The Ministry of Labour and Social Affairs, which is in charge of these two prisons, say that they have no money to improve conditions, and they do the best they can. It's extraordinary that they can't find more money to deal with this desperate problem. The Iraqi government is sitting on billions of dollars of revenue from oil exports, and they're not spending it. The United States is spending billions of dollars on upgrading the Iraqi military and the Iraqi police. Couldn't they spend $1 million or two? It can't require very much money to have decent cooling facilities and improve the living conditions for these young men.
Jonathan, many thanks.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
5 people died in accidents related to heavy rain over the last few days. There have been floods in northeastern England, Shropshire, and Herefordshire and Worcestershire. The Guardian's Martin Wainwright met people affected in North Yorkshire.
I'm in Pickering, where, would you believe it, the Redcar lifeboat crew have been stationed these last couple of days. That's about 35 miles away from Redcar they are, but not just that, they're inland. You don't normally get a lifeboat operating in a place like this, but they've had to because the Rye Beck here in Pickering shot up. There was so much rain on the North York Moors. It rose up got into some houses. And the curious thing, the interesting thing about these floods we have now, with these sudden, very heavy rain, is that it's gone down just as quickly. And sun's shining now, there are tourists everywhere, and you wouldn't think that anything had happened. And the beck, I'm just crossing over the beck now, and it looks like what it normally does, a relatively innocuous stream, although it's a lot browner than usual because it's bringing with it so much stuff from down on the North York Moors. There's a lady here who's in her 91st year called Topsy Kling, and she lives at Beck Isle Cottage, and if her cottage floods, that's usually the sign that Pickering's in for a bad time. So I'm just going to see if she's around. So I've arrived at the cottage of Topsy Kling. How close did it get, Topsy?
It wasn't as high.
No, you stay here.
Shall I show you outside?
Okay, yes.
That should be better, won't it?
That's lovely. Topsy's just going to show me the high water mark.
Up to here, this time.
So you were about 10 minutes away, probably, from being flooded? Something like that, you know, if it had carried on rising?
It was all across there. I couldn't get out. It was right away up there, right across.
Yes. How long were you stuck in the house for?
Till this morning.
So overnight as well, yes, it was still...
It's up all night to see it go down, but, I mean, apparently it went down about 4 o'clock. It was stationary from about 3 o'clock. It was holding its own. But this time it has come in an entirely different way altogether.
Topsy's just showing me a gravel lane at the end of her road, and the gravel's all been washed down. And
I mean, when I came in from shopping, I walked along here, then all of a sudden the water came from here and I had to run into the house.
I literally run in?
I had to run in the house because it was moving like this.
And last year, your Topsy lives in this lovely cottage with roses up the front, just, you know, the classic...
She's got them down this year now.
Well, they're beautiful, pink roses and red roses. Yeah. But last year you suffered quite badly, I think.
Oh, yes, I was away. I've only just got back about nicely, I should say 2 months ago from last time.
Really? It's taken all that time to repair it?
So it did, because it was all gutted from head to foot.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that could be done, do you think? I mean...
Well, the environment... Yes, we want the rivers dredging. What's the matter with them?
Well, it's a great pleasure talking to you.
Do you want to give a coffee?
I better get back because I've got to talk to one or two other people and then go back to Leeds. Mm. I should never ask a lady her age, but have I been told you're 91? Is that right?
Yes.
Goodness. Well, it's...
This is my 90th birthday present, was this last year.
Really?
We're preparing for a little party.
In June?
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
And we couldn't have it because the Beck decided to come up.
Well, I'm so glad it's missed you this time. I've just come to the Beck Isle Museum, which I strongly recommend if you're ever in Pickering. And you weren't underwater here, were you?
No, it got as far as the gate.
Did you have to put bags up?
Well, we have a Victorian schoolroom, and they came in yesterday and lifted the exhibits off the floor.
I remember last year, Pickering had a bit of a going over from flood.
We had canoes in the marketplace.
It's not been so bad this time, but...
No, it hasn't, no. I mean, it did a lot of damage. I mean, for example, our local television shop, it did about £70,000 worth.
Is it something that can be prevented, or if you get such...
Nothing's been done. It's scandalous, in my view.
What could be done?
Well, they could dredge the beck to start with.
I've just come down to the beck now, and there's a couple of lads and a friend of theirs fishing. The river's quite high now, but what was it like yesterday? I gather you were out here fishing yesterday.
The water was right up there by the wall down there.
Where the museum is?
Yeah, near the museum. And, well, it was all under the bridges. And
Are you used to that in Pickering? I mean, it's happened before, hasn't it?
Yeah, it happened last year. Worse than that last year, though.
Because I think this time it didn't get... Did it not get into any houses this time here in Pickering?
I don't think so.
Because there's loads of sandbags everywhere, isn't there?
Yeah.
And did you catch any fish?
No, didn't manage to.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Today's producers were Sonia Rothwell and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.